when this perturbation theory is organized and decomposed in terms of Feynman diagram. So remember, Feynman diagrams are a way to write the term of perturbation theory using Vick's theorem, so decomposing the quantum process in terms of elementary single processes that are creation and alienation of particles. So it's a way to express a quantum process. And so we are not going to discuss yet the physics contained in these Feynman diagrams, how the properties of the free theory is modified when you plug in the interaction. We are going to still discuss some important feature of the structure of this perturbation theory. And we shall apply this next week to discuss renormalization theory. So remember, we had a phi 4 theory with an interaction term which was G phi 4, free field plus G phi to the 4. And when expanding the quantities in, for instance, the correlation functions, we got those Feynman diagram and those Feynman rules. And basically, remember, we had a propagator that I represent by a line between 2 points, x1, x2. And this propagator represents, in Minkowski space, just the Feynman propagator between x1 and x2. So the expectation value in the vacuum of the time ordered product of two free fields at point x1 and x2. In Euclidean space, it's Fourier transform that I denote g of x1 of x2. And we have interaction vertices. That are four legs, so four propagators comes at each vertex. And there is, so to each vertex is associated a position x. And there is a factor which is minus g, where g is a coupling constant in the Euclidean case. And in the Minkowski setting, this is minus IG. Okay? And finally, remember that we had, in fact, H bar factors coming out because we have an H bar in the functional integral. So, in fact, there is an H bar in front of each propagator and a 1 over H bar in terms of. Each vertex, okay? But you see that there would be a lot of constellation between the h-bar associated to the propagator and the h-bars associated to the vertices. And as we shall see later on, in fact, we shall see that there is, in fact, a simple expansion in H bar factor. So perturbation theory corresponds to expanding in powers of the Planck's constant. Okay. So let me first show you again the pictures that we had. Is it working? I was told that if I push lights, it goes down. Little bit. Mm-hmm. No, it's not. So it's not this. I think it's what has to go there. Is there something called light, a button called just to dim something? Yeah, something like that. Hold off is perhaps too big, but that's fine. Okay, that's better. Okay, thank you. So we saw that in the expansion in terms of Feynman diagrams. In the partition function appears vacuum diagrams, diagrams that are not connected to any external points that represent the insertion of some field operator at a fixed point. And here are the list of the connected diagram at zero order, first order in perturbation theory, second order, etc. At the moment, I won't discuss what this is. This will come out a bit later. The two-point function, all the diagrams at first order and second order are represented here, and you see that they are connected. Now, one subtle point. The connected vacuum diagram have a property that is not shared by all the diagram of the two-point function. See, for instance, consider this diagram. This diagram, if you remove this line, this vertex is disconnected from the rest of the diagram. But if you remove this line, all the vertices remains connected by propagator. You see. So the same here. This part of the diagram has its property. This part of the diagram has this property, but the diagram as a whole doesn't have this property. Same here, same here. So I have represented in this blue box the part of the diagram that have the property that they are called irreducible, or one line irreducible. They remain connected if you remove a single line. Okay. And you see that, well, for some reason, in the 5-4 theory, all the vacuum diagrams have this property of irreducibility. But the diagram of the two-point function, even if they are connected, only small parts, some small pieces of it have this property of irreducibility. Okay. But you see, of course, that the two-point function, as it's clear here, is just a chain of those irreducible diagrams connected by propagators. Okay. And the same structures appears in the four-point function. So here are all the diagrams of the four-point function up to order, first order in the coupling constant. You see that some of the diagrams are disconnected, as we discussed yesterday. And among those diagrams, all those diagrams, only one diagram is connected. It's this interaction vertex. If we go at, what's going on here? A bit strange. If we go to second order in the four-point function and consider only the connected diagram, so second order in the coupling constant, two vertices, there are many more diagrams. But again, these connected diagrams are in general not irreducible, but are made out of small pieces that are irreducible. This one that we saw before, this one. And, well, by definition of irreducibility, we consider that a single vertex is irreducible. If you take just the point, it's irreducible because you cannot remove any line to make it disconnected. So it's just a definition. Okay. So again, the four-point function, the graph of the four-point function, you know, you see have a tree structure of ensemble of irreducible parts connected by propagator. But if you reduce all the irreducible part to a point, you obtain a diagram that has a structure of a tree. Okay. And this continue at next order. If you consider the six-point function, well, here are the diagrams that appears up to order three in the coupling constant for the six-point function, the connected diagram. Among all those diagrams that are connected, only you see that these diagrams have made out of irreducible parts connected by propagators, you see? And you see that you get the irreducible diagram that we already met in the two and four-point function. And we have this new irreducible diagram that is a single triangle that appears at for the 6-point function. Okay. So it's quite natural, in fact, to consider those irreducible diagrams and the contribution obtained by using the Feynman rules. Consider only the irreducible diagram, because in some sense, you see, they are the building blocks of perturbation theory. Out of those, if you know the value of this irreducible diagram, of the contribution of this irreducible diagram, it's quite easy to reconstruct the contribution of the connected diagram and then of the general disconnected diagram. It's quite easy. Okay. So in some sense, you see here graphically that they have some kind of, you know, building blocks or core of perturbation theory. If you understand the structure of this irreducible diagram, you understand already a lot. Okay. So let me consider now what I called correlation function or associated to the one particle irreducible diagram. So instead of considering the contribution by applying the Feynman rule to the Wool diagram, I just retain the contribution of the irreducible diagram. Okay, for the vacuum diagram, there is not much difference because all the diagrams are irreducible. But now for the two-point function, what I'm going to do is that, you see, if I have a diagram like that, I remove the propagator to keep only. So as a Feynman rule, I said that the line, the propagator that is attached to this vertex, I cut it, which means that I suppress the propagator. So I replace the propagator given by such a function by just one, a delta function in position space, or its Fourier transform, one in momentum space. You see. Okay? And you will notice, I will explain that later, there is a change of sign. I get a plus sign here instead of minus sign, and here I get a minus sign. And well, this will become clear why we do that later. I had the propagator has two external legs. Well, it has one external leg, but which is the legs attached to both vertices. So if I apply these cut rules, I cut two times the propagator. It means, which means that basically I multiply two times by the Laplace operator minus Laplace plus m squared. So in fact, I will associate to this two-cut propagator either the kernel of minus delta, the Laplacian plus m squared, or in Fourier space, p squared plus m squared instead of 1 over p squared plus m squared. At the moment, take it as a definition. And now, for the four-point function, well, the irreducible four-point function is a function of the four points, but I have cut the propagator, so this is g times the delta function when all the z's has to be at the same point. That's the rule. Here, I do the same thing, so I get this contribution of this diagram made out of two vertices connected by two propagators, but the cut propagator here means that the point 1 and the point 2 have to be at the same point, and the point 3 and the point 4 have to be at the same point. You have these diagrams. You have two equivalent diagrams obtained by relabeling, you know, taking the different vertices. And here are, for completeness, the two different irreducible diagrams that appears at third order in the coupling constant for the irreducible four-point function. Okay? So the rule is compute this. And again, for completeness, the irreducible four-point function is given by the contribution of this triangle variable, which is a contribution of order G3. And here you have 15 different ways to attach those external points to this triangle. And at second order, you have more diagrams. You have, if I'm not mistaken, three different kinds of diagrams. And you have a much larger number of ways to attach the external vertices to the internal vertices of this irreducible part. Okay, so here are the rules. So can you switch off the room will turn off. I don't know what I did. Okay. Yes. Good. Okay. So now I'm going to explain why, what it means, and why is this useful. But before that, I'm going to introduce a very important tool. I'm going to introduce what is called generating functions. So generating functions for the correlation function of the Phi-4 theory are just a tool to manipulate and compute all correlation functions in a single object. And let me define what it is. Remember, first, we were interested into computing vacuum expectation value of products of operator. So let me introduce, so we had a functional integral that was integral d phi exponential of minus, well, let me vote in the Euclidean case, but in the Minkowski case, it will be exactly the same. But for simplicity, to avoid the I factor, I will get in the Euclidean. I'm sorry, this is the Euclidean action of phi. So I'm in an Euclidean setting. So this was the partition function of my theory. Now, imagine that I add to this a term like that, so that the partition function now depends on an object called G. And what does it mean, this? G here means a classical, so it's a function of x. And the scalar product g finds is a shortened notation for simply the integral over space of g of x, phi of x. You see. So if I'm able to compute this functional integral, the partition function becomes a functional of this classical function. So this classical function is called a source term, but you can view it also as a classical field. It's some kind of classical background field. And this term describes a coupling between phi, that is a quantum field, and G, which is a classical. See. And phi, of course, describes a quantum field because phi is integrated out in the functional integral. So that expectation value of phi becomes a matrix element of a quantum operator phi. But G remains a classical background field. Okay? So why do we consider this object? That's because if we make a functional derivative at a given point g of x of exponential 1 over h bar g dot phi. The rules of functional calculation, functional calculus, tells you that this is simply phi of x times exponential 1 over h bar g times phi. That's an application of the calculation you have been doing yesterday in the tutorial and that you have been doing in the front-end course on functional calculation. Okay. So you see that each time that you take a functional derivative with respect to g gives a phi in front of the integral. So, you see that the, so that's a way to bring down phi operator at given point and to construct the Green function of the theory. So, now let me define, remember, we had the Green function of the theory, phi of x1. Phi of xn. Okay, I'm in Euclidean, so I don't care about the time ordered products, but this, okay. And let me define now generating function that I will call g of g. For these Green or correlation functions that I will call g of, and if I want to be really consistent with the notation I had yesterday, this will be g of z1, zn. Okay, so this is a Green function. So let me define a function g of g, simply of this g, like g of g, well, this will be a, let me use the calligraphic notation to be sure, g of z will be defined as a formal sum, sum from n equals 0 to infinity of 1 over factorial n, integral over all the position of these points, g of z1, g of zn, g of z1, zn. Okay, so at that level, this is a bit formal. So that's a functional. And you see that, why is it called a generating function? Because if you know this function of this classical background field, if you expand it in g, around g equals 0, you get all the correlation functions. So this abstract integral sum of integrals contains all the information about the correlation function, the vacuum expectation value of products of operator of your theory. Okay. So in particular, if you want to compute g of z1, zn, this is simply the functional derivative at point g1 that gets you a phi z1 up to a functional derivative g of zn of this functional generating functional taken at g equals 0. Okay. And that's why I put the 1 over factorial n. So this is just the Taylor expansion in g of this functional generating functional. Okay, so now, remember, this can be defined, calculated via functional integrals. And it's very easy to see that this generic function for the Green function or the correlation function of my theory is simply g of g equal z of g divided by z of 0. Okay, simply because if I set g equals 0 Here, I just get the partition function, which has to be put at the denominator in order to normalize correctly the expectation value. Okay. So here is the relation between g of g. Okay. So this is, in fact, this function contains, can be written as a sum over all the diagrams of the theory simply without vacuum parts. Okay? So those are all the diagrams that appears in this the perturbative expansion in terms of Feynman diagram of the correlation function. Okay? And those are all the diagrams, but without the vacuum parts, because the vacuum part is subtracted by the denominator, the partition function. Okay? Good. And one last remark. Of course, there is a factor. If I do that, there is a factor 1 over h bar. So in fact, I forgot the factor h bar minus n. OK. Good. So now,
vacuum parts. How do you deal with the J's? Do they come in as just external legs?
Yes. To each G is associated an external legs. Simply those, for instance, the time of order G of X1 or Z1, G of Z2 will give you a diagram like this diagram, plus this diagram, plus etc. But it will not give but this diagram. It's not there, as we have seen yesterday. It's not there because it's there, but it's there and the contribution cancels. Okay. Good. So now we may be interested in computing the same object, but for all the diagrams, all the connected diagram. So let me define a generating function for the connected diagrams. So formally, it will be defined simply as, so let me call it W. It will be a functional of the same G. And it will be defined simply as, similar to that, as a sum over all connected diagrams. OK? So can we express the generating function for all the connected diagrams, so all the diagrams that I show you on the screen at the beginning of the course, in terms of the previously defined generating function? Well, that's quite easy, in fact, because the solution is that this is simply h bar times the logarithm of z of g. Well, the h bar is here for convenient normalization. Okay? And why is it so? Well, if this is true, you can invert this formula and write z of g as exponential of course, of 1 over h bar w of g. Okay? Now, so expand the exponential, this means that this is 1 plus 1 over h bar w of g plus 1 half, well, there is an h bar squared, w of g, plus etc. Okay. So assume that indeed w of g is defined as the sum of all the connected diagrams. Assume that this is true. Assume that w equals the sum over all, let me draw it, all the connected diagrams. I draw this in a very sketchy and graphical way. That's the sum of the contribution of all the diagrams that are connected. Okay. So what is this? Then, this is just 1, which you can say that 1 is a contribution of the diagram with no vertex, the vacuum diagram. The empty diagram. You know, the contribution of the empty set, the set that has no element. Okay? This is the sum of a contribution of connected diagrams. This is up to this h bar factor. There is an h bar here, I'm sorry. Okay, here you get the sum of a two. So you get the sum of a contribution of some connected diagram 1 and of some other connected diagram C prime, let's say. C denotes the fact that it's connected. So this is a connected diagram, sum of a connected diagram C. And C, this is the sum of a pair of connected diagrams C and C prime. Okay? So that's the contribution of a diagram made out of two disconnected pieces. A disconnected diagram, made out of two connected pieces. Okay. And why is it the factor 1/2 here? The factor 1/2 that is in front of that comes simply from the fact that they are indistinguishable. So you cannot make a distinction between this diagram and this diagram, C prime and C prime and C. So if you are counting with a factor 1, you are counting twice the same diagram. So in order not to count twice the same disconnected diagram made out of two different pieces, you have to add this factor 1/2. Okay? And then this goes on. The next term will be the sum over all the disconnected diagram made out of three pieces. And there will be a factor 1/3, since you have to take into account all the permutation of these different pieces. Okay. So you see that if W is given by the sum over all the connected diagram, Z is the sum over all diagrams made out of connected pieces, you see, including the vacuum diagram. Okay, and since we know, since this is a bijection, in fact, in terms of diagram, since we know that this is true, this implies that this is true. The two statements are equivalent. Okay, so you see, you have a simple, very simple graphical proof. Of course, it's a bit sketchy, but you don't have to go at all the contribution, compute things, compare first the diagram at order g, g squared, etc. This is a graphical direct proof of this relation. Okay. So this formalism is quite powerful. Okay. Well, of course, the idea of using generating function to count graphical objects like that was not invented for doing quantum field theory. In fact, the idea to to manipulate objects by constructing generative function goes back to the end of the 18th century. It was invented by Leonhard Euler for, of course, different mathematical problems. Okay. So now, is there the same thing for irreducible diagram? There is one that I will present now. It's based on the concept of effective action. And the concept of effective action is something very important because it's also very important, both mathematical tool and a tool to get some insights on the physics of quantum field theories. So let me define it. And then I will show that this object has the right property. The definition of the effective action goes through a mathematical transformation called the Legendre transform. And the Legendre transform, I will recall what its definition, it's something which is familiar in physics. For instance, when you go to the, in thermodynamics, to when you go from the internal energy of a system to its free energy, you are doing a Legendre transform, where you are going from the energy to the enthalpy of a system, you are doing a Legendre transform. So basically, a Legendre transform means I study the same system in terms of two different variables. One variable or the response of the system to this variable. So let me show how it works here. Now, consider, let me start from this object. And let me consider what is the expectation value of the quantum merit operator phi located at point x, but when g is different from zero. So I am considering the quantum theory where the quantum field is coupled to the source term, but the source term is not set to zero. So I'm considering a different quantum theory than the original quantum theory where g was equal to zero. I modify it a little bit. So expectation value of the operators will be different. You see, the quantum system responds to a perturbation by the classical source term, okay? So this value, the value of phi at point x, it's a complicated function, but it depends on g. And it depends on the value of g not only at the point x, but at the other points too, because the quantum field propagates, you see? So this depends on g of y at all y different from x, because the quantum field propagates. So it's a functional of the value of g. But this is the expectation value of a quantum operator. So this is a number. Let me call this number phi of x. So this is a function of x that depends on g. So this is a classical function of x of space, but it depends on the source term g of y at all the points y different from x. So this phi is a function of x, and it's still a functional of g. You have to get used to that. You have a function that is a function of a classical variable and a functional of another field. Okay? So, but you can compute it. So this will be called the background field. That's the average value of the quantum field in the theory. So if you are far away, you don't know that the theory is quantum, you make a measurement of phi on a different different scale, you get a number, okay, you say, okay, my theory as a field is described by a field phi of x. So it's some kind of classical description of the quantum field when you make the average. And you don't care about the higher order correlation functions, okay? Good. So now, what is the Legendre transform? The Legendre transform, by definition, consists in expressing the properties of the theory in terms of phi rather than in terms of g. What are the properties express the theory in terms of phi of x rather than g of y? Okay. So for that, we do the Legendre transform. The Legendre transform is defined like that. By definition, it is defined, it's a functional of this background field that is defined as g dot phi minus w of g, where w is defined here. So you see, and as usual, g dot phi means integral over dx, g of x, phi of x. So you see, now both g and phi are classical functions. You can multiply them. But simply, of course, g, as I've said, phi is a functional of g. So I can make an interversion of variable. This is all very formal, but I consider that g is a functional with not to n of phi. Say a change of implicit variables. So a priori, this seems very complicated to compute, but will turn out that if you know how to compute that, this functional gamma of phi, which is minus w of g plus g times phi, when we re-express g here as a function of phi, instead of expressing phi as a function of g, this object that is called the effective potential is what is called, is very interesting. And of course, remember, phi is the expectation value of the, in the functional integral of phi expressively. So what is the relation between phi and, what is the relation between phi and g? Phi of x is just the functional derivative of w of g x but then g of y is simply not set to zero. You see? So the Legendre transform means, what does it mean? We have a function w of g. We define phi as the derivative of w with respect to g. Then we take this object and we invert the relation g to phi. Okay? So this is the definition of the effective action. Okay? And this effective action has very, very nice property. First, a general property of Legendre transform is that it's an evolution. So the Legendre transform of the Legendre transform is the original function. So in particular, we have that W of G equal, and that's obvious here, that W of G equal G dot phi minus gamma of phi. That's the first part that is trivial. The slightly non-trivial part is that G of X is the functional derivative of gamma of phi when you make a variation of phi at point X. Yes?
Sorry, which quantity up there is the effective action?
The quantity effective action is gamma.
That's called the effective potential.
Did I call it effective potential? No, I called it effective potential.
I think I thought I heard that word.
No, this is
the definition of the effective action. It corresponds to what is called the effective potential in thermodynamics. So you have replaced G by an external magnetic field to some system. This will become the effective thermodynamical potential or the Gibbs potential of the magnetic system expressed as a function of the magnetization instead of the applied magnetic field. So mathematically, it's the same object. Yes?
Why is phi the functional derivative of W and not Z? Because at this stage, don't we have our correlation?
That's a general property of Legendre transform.
Okay.
Okay. And basically, it comes from the fact that if I consider that phi is a function of g, I may be interested in computing delta g of x divided, well, delta phi of x is equal to delta g of y. And it turns out that this is the inverse of delta g of y of x as a matrix. So it's just a simple rule of change of variable. Yes?
All the j except for at x.
No, I'm sorry.
It depends, of course. What I meant was not that it doesn't depend on phi of g at point x. I mean that it depends on all the value of g at all the point y and not only of g at point x. I'm sorry. That's what I meant.
Why?
If g goes to zero, you just recover the expectation value of phi for the original theory. That's just a special point. Okay? Good. So it turns out that it is this effective action that is the generating function of the sum over all irreducible diagram, which means that when you expand it in terms of phi, it is sum from n equals 0 to infinity, 1 over factorial n, integral dz1 dzn, phi of z1, phi of zn, times a function gamma of z1 up to zn. And this function gamma z of z1, z of zn is just nothing but the contribution of all the irreducible one particle diagram with external truncated legs connected to Z1, Z2, up to Zn. Okay. So that's something that starts to be non-trivial. This property is just a general property of the Legendre transform. This comes out from the specific fact that W of G is defined from Z of G, that is defined by this functional integral over the fields. Okay? So I won't give you the full proof of that, but let me show you how it works for a specific quantum field theory like the phi 4 theory. Okay, so let me go back to the specific case where we have an action S of phi, which is in general, so I will consider a slightly more general case than the phi 4 theory, which is an action like that. Okay? And so this is a classical action. I omit the Euclidean, I omit the E subscript, but we are in Euclidean setting. Okay? And what we are going to do is we are going to compute gamma of phi at first order in H bar. So we are going to compute the first quantum correction to the classical theory. And we are going to do that using simply Gaussian integrals. Okay. So let us consider, we start from this functional integral where Z of G is the integral d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar S of phi minus g phi. Okay, that's the definition I've wrote before. If assume that h bar, the parameter h bar is very small. As I remember, h bar is of course a constant of nature, but we may consider a given action where this coefficient is fixed, this coefficient is fixed, and h bar is a parameter that we set to zero. We are doing math. Okay. So if h bar is equal to zero, it is clear that this integral is dominated by the saddle point, namely the minimum of S of phi minus G phi. Okay. So let us look for this minimum. This minimum, let me call it phi c. Phi c for classical or saddle point. Okay. Phi c is given, of course, by the equation that, let me write this like that. Delta s over delta phi of x minus g of x equals zero. Okay? Which, so this is the equation for the saddle point. Okay. And in our case, if you know very well your rules of functional integration, this equation becomes minus the Laplace operator with respect to x of phi c plus the derivative of the potential v phi at point vc equal g. OK. Okay, so this is a general form of the equation. And this is the explicit form for the explicit action we have been considering. Okay? And let me denote, for simplicity, I will denote delta s over delta phi of x. I will denote this the derivative of s prime with respect to phi at point x. So that's the shortened notation. So it's not a, it's a derivative with respect to phi at point x. Okay? And this is, it is this object. Minus delta x of phi c plus v prime of phi c, of course, evaluated at point x. Okay? So now, of course, the idea when using the saddle point expression is to expand around this classical solution. You see, this classical solution depends on G, of course. It's a functional of G because this, the solution of this equation depends in a non-trivial way of G. And since there is a Laplace operator, when you invert it, this is a wave equation. So the value of phi at point, at a given point, depends on the source value of the source term at a different point. There is propagation, the classical propagation of the field. Okay. Okay, so I expand around phi. So now I make a change of variable. I write that in my functional integral here, I write phi equal phi c plus a small variation, let us call it phi tilde, okay, that in some sense measures the quantum fluctuation. Okay. And let me expand the action. Let me expand this term. We found that S of phi minus G times phi, if we re-expressed it in terms of phi c and phi tilde, becomes, of course, S of phi c minus G phi c, that's the classical term. Then we have a term proportional to phi tilde. So this is a classical term. Then we have a term proportional to phi tilde. And this term is phi tilde dot, with this notation for the dot, times s prime at point x minus g. This is the term of order one. And then, if we go to second order, we have a term that we can write. We are just doing a perturbative expansion of a functional. Phi tilde dot the second derivative. Of course, this is at the position phi c. This is s prime at phi c. Phi tilde. Plus higher order terms. So this means phi tilde of x times this object. We know that this is equal to zero. Phi c is defined so that s prime of phi c minus g is equal to zero. So this term cancels. That's because phi c is a saddle point. So it remains the second order term. And what does this second order term mean? I'm sorry, I'm eating the most important part of what I'm doing. Yes. So what does this mean? This means simply integral over dx 1, dx 2, phi tilde of x 1, phi tilde of x 2, and an object that is the s dot of phi c at point x 1, x 2. Well, this is the same x1, x2, you see, where this object is simply, let me write it here, the second derivative of the action at point x1, x2 is simply the second functional derivative of the action of phi with respect to phi at point x1 and at phi at point x2, evaluated at phi equal the saddle point. And now, I hope you are familiar with the rule of functional derivative. So this is nothing but the second derivative with respect to phi of this term. You see? Of course, there is a g term, but it is linear in phi, so it has disappeared. So this is the second derivative with respect to phi of this. So this is the operator minus Laplacian plus the second derivative of the potential of the field phi. And this is the kernel operator, the kernel of this differential operator evaluated at point x1, x2. So, of course, it takes value only if x1 is equal to x2. But here you have an operator. So it is this differential operator. So this is means this is a differential operator. That depends on phi, phi, and taken at phi equal phi c. So keep in mind this results because it's very important. Okay? And so the action becomes the classical action, the linear term disappears, and the quadratic term is given by the quadratic form whose kernel is this differential operator. Okay? Hope it's okay. So let me now continue the calculation. Of course, why do we expand? We expand because we assume that h bar is small, so that, in fact, remember, we have a 1 over h bar here. So it's natural to consider that the fluctuations are small, order square root of h bar, so that this will become a term of h bar 1 half, but it disappears. And then there is factor h bar that cancel. That is cancelled by this factor here. Okay? So what we end up with that g of g, okay, at this order is given, of course, by exponential of 1 over h bar g times phi classical phi s minus s of phi s. Okay, so that's the dominant term. And then we have a term that comes from the integration over the phi tilde. And integrating over the phi tilde, we are integrating a Gaussian, yes?
Where did the factor h part to the 1 half come from? Why
no, it's just I normalize. It's just a change of expansion. I said phi in the functional integral is phi c plus h bar phi tilde. You see? So in that case, the equation becomes d phi tilde exponential minus 1/2 phi tilde times this operator here. That is the second derivative of the action for the field phi c times phi c plus higher order term. So I just change the variable so that it's clear that this is of order exponential of 1 over h bar, and this is exponential of a quadratic form. And then I have correction of order h bar 1/2 in addition that I can neglect. So this is a Gaussian integration, integrating over the phi tilde can be done. And what he got, this is exponential of minus 1 over h bar g dot phi c minus the classical action for phi c. Then I get the determinant, the functional determinant of this operator to the power minus 1/2. So this is functional determinant of the differential operator S dot of phi c equal minus the Laplacian plus the second derivative, the potential taken for the phi c. And remember, phi c depends on the source term g, because phi c is given by this equation. Okay. So now the beauty of this formula is that we can compute the effective action quite easily. First, let us compute the generating function for the connected diagram. This is simply h bar times the log of z. So this is g dot phi c minus s of phi c. This is a classical term. And then we get the logarithm of this determinant. We get a factor h bar, so we get a minus h bar over 2. And we get the logarithm of the determinant of this operator. But remember, we have the magic formula that the logarithm of the determinant is the trace of the logarithm. So this is the trace of an operator that is defined formally as the logarithm of this differential operator. And then we have high order terms that will turn out to be of order h squared. OK. So we have a quite simple formula for the generating functional of the W of G. OK. So now let us compute, let us perform the Legendre transform. Okay. So we want to compute the background field. Background field. Phi which, remember, is the derivative of W with respect to G. Okay. So, we have to take the derivative of G with respect of this term with respect to G. There are two terms. There is a term which comes from the fact that there is an explicit dependence on G here. So first we get phi C, the saddle point for the field itself. But then phi C depends on G. So in addition, we have to take into account G times delta of phi C over dG minus delta of S. I'm sorry. We have to take into account the fact that phi C depends explicitly on G. So we have to write the dependence of phi C with respect to G. I'm a bit sketchy. Times the derivative with respect to phi C to phi of G phi minus S of phi taken at phi equal phi C. See? And then we have the functional derivative of this term. It's a complicated object. We can compute it, but it will be of order h bar. And it turns out that we won't need it. Okay. But now remember, this is G minus S prime of phi, this term, taken at phi C. But what is this? This is simply the equation that defines the saddle point. So this is zero. So we get a very simple result. The background field phi is equal to the value of the saddle point up to correction of order h bar. The background field equals the saddle point of the original equation plus correction. Okay. And it turns out that that's all what we need. So then, we are in fact almost done. And let me take still 5 minutes to show you the result. Because the result is so nice that. So now, let us compute the effective action. So let us take the Legendre transform. Let us define gamma of phi as g dot phi minus w of g. Okay? So remember that we have the expression for w. So this is g phi minus G phi C plus S of phi C plus h bar over 2 trace of the logarithm of the differential differential operator, of this differential operator. Okay? So we can rewrite, remember, we have g here and here. So this is g times phi minus phi c plus s of phi c plus h bar over 2 trace of the logarithm of this differential operator. Okay? But remember that phi is equal to phi c at order h bar. So this is a term of order h bar. This is a term of order 1, but since phi c is equal to the background field phi plus a term of order h bar, there is a correction. And this is a term of order h bar with phi c. So remember, we know that phi c is equal to phi plus the correction of order h bar. Okay? So we can rewrite s of phi as s. Well, let me write this as a delta phi with an h bar. Okay? S of phi c is equal to s of phi plus h bar delta phi s prime of phi. I'm expanding the action around phi. And those are terms of order h bar squared. So this can be rewritten as, and this is delta phi. So this can be rewritten as delta phi times g minus s prime of phi plus term of order h bar plus h bar over 2 trace log of s dot of phi c. S second derivative of s respect to phi c. Okay. But remember, the equation of motion is that this is g minus s prime of phi c plus some term of order h bar. And this is of order h bar already. And this is zero. That's the equation of motion. Okay. So all this is a term of order h bar squared. Now, here we have the trace of the log of the second derivative of the action at phi c. We can replace phi c by phi up to correction of order h bar in a term which is multiplied by h bar. So we get something that is of order h bar squared. So finally, we can rewrite that. What remains? This term has disappeared. This term has been replaced by s of phi. You see? Of course, there was an s of phi that I forgot here. Sorry. Plus s of phi. So the final result is that the effective action is just s of phi, the classical action taken at the value of the background field, plus h bar over 2 trace of the logarithm of this operator, that is the second derivative of the action at phi, plus term of order h bar squared. This is gamma. of phi. So this is a relatively remarkably simple result. You see, the effective action is just the classical action plus a first quantum correction that is proportional to just the trace of the logarithm, or if you prefer, the logarithm of the functional determinant of the second derivative. And again, just to be clear, remember that S dot of phi is in fact the functional operator minus the Laplacian plus the derivative. Okay. So that's a very nice formula. Of course, it's valid at order h bar, then. But this contains all the quantum correction, the leading quantum corrections. OK. And this result is very general. I haven't used at all, in fact, the form of the action. I wrote the explicit form of this operator for the action I started from, but I never used this in the calculation to derive this. So this is a fully general result. It is valid for all quantum field theory with bosonic fields. I'm using the fact that I'm doing Gaussian integration over real variables. Okay? So in fact, it's true not only for the scalar field, but it is also true for gauge theories. This formula can be used also and has been used when trying to quantize the quantum gravity in a semi-classical framework. Well, it's very difficult, but you can replace phi by fluctuation of the metric and make calculation. You see? So the only subtleties is that when you are dealing with fermions, the formula is modified because the fermions anti-commute. But we are going to treat to show how one can make functional quantization with fermions next week or the beginning of the third week. Okay, so for all quantum field theory with bosonic fields, this formula is valid. Okay, and Monday, next Monday, what I'm going to do is that I'm going to take this explicit formula, take the phi 4 theory we started from, and so that this contains all the irreducible diagram that has proportional to h bar, namely this contains all the one loop diagrams. The diagrams that have only one internal loops. Yes?
But Richard, why are we just keeping the first order quantum fluctuations?
That's because I am doing the calculation at that order. I could have been, well, it's possible to do the calculation at the next order, but it becomes much more complicated.
So in general, what you said that you will have in here the one loop corrections, the next order will have second loop corrections.
Yeah, so in fact, this will give two loop corrections. Etc. In fact, I can just draw a picture, but this is a classical contribution. The time of h bar gives something like all the diagram with one loop and some external legs. And basically, there is only one loop, one kind of loops. The time of order h bar squared will contain diagram with two loops. And diagram with two loops may be diagrams like that, with some external legs. Well, I'm considering a general theory that may have cubic couplings like in gauge theories, or diagrams like that. with external legs. Okay, so if you walk a bit more, and a bit lot more, you saw that the term over h bar are contained by a diagram like that. The diagram that's order h cube then contains many more diagrams, diagrams like that, diagrams like that, diagrams like the tetrahedra, etc. But there is a finite number of diagrams that contributes, etc. What we did was just to look at the simplest case, which is this one. Okay? Yes?
So this is a detective action.
Yes.
You're actually computing, like, you know, the correlation function of the effective action, right? But what we really care about is the correlation function of the quantum field.
Yes. But as I explained at the beginning of the lectures, once you have the correlation, I just mentioned that in my passing, but since the correlation function for the connected function is the Lejeune transform of the effective action, if you know the effective action, you can do Lejeune transform back, get the correlation function for the correlated function, and then get all the correlation function. So in fact, once you know this effective action, you can go back quite easily. That's much easier to go back to the physical correlation function, because all the quantum effects are contained in those correlation functions. In general, if you have, for instance, if you consider a four-point function, but a general four-point function, you can write it as, decompose it as a series of processes like that. Where this is irreducible. So these are some contribution of the effective action. Okay. And so you see a classical propagation of, these are classical propagators. This is the classical propagator solution of the wave equation. So this is a classical propagation of particle modified by, dressed by quantum effects, and with an interaction here that is modified by quantum effects. So all the quantum effects are contained here. This contains classical propagation. Quantum effects. Okay? I will show that on Monday when we are going to do the explicit calculation. Okay? So sorry for being a bit late, but I wanted to finish the calculation to get the results, because it's very important.